Good morning, everyone, and thank you for being here. The joint meeting of Education Policy and E-12 Finance will come to order. Thank you, Senator Torres-Ray, for having a joint meeting with our committee. And today we're going to focus on three things. First, the previous session, just a review of the actions that were taken and maybe a bit more of a focus on some of the items that were in the House bill that may not have had as much attention but ultimately became law. And we have three of our trusted staff professionals here to provide those insights. Then we're going to get an update on various task force findings. We charged several task forces to develop recommendations to the legislature, and we're pleased the department's here with several of the chairs of these task forces to give us a report on where the recommendations might be headed as we prepare for the upcoming session. And then finally, we'll get some comments about the 2014 session. I don't believe they have the formal presentation with proposals yet, but we've heard a lot about the unsession, and there'll be talk about the recommendations from task forces, et cetera, but the department's going to provide some comments on that. And if there's time, we can certainly preview some of the ideas that we may have in a non-budget year, if you will, but we'll see what that forecast and other items have to say in the near future. So that's the big picture on the agenda. Any questions before we proceed? Okay. Well, our first item on the agenda is for the staff to provide an overview of the 2013 session, recap, looking ahead, and I'll ask each of you to introduce yourself and go in the order that you have arranged.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Jay Wilms. I'm the fiscal analyst for the E-12 committee.
And I might add, welcome back. You just returned from your honeymoon yesterday or so. From where?
Thailand, actually, in Bali. So I'm a little bit jet-lagged.
Welcome back.
My name is Bjorn Arneson. I'm the legislative analyst for the education committees.
And I'm Anne Marie Butler, your Senate counsel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Madam Chair, for this opportunity. I think our goals for today are not to do a terribly deep dive into any particular item from the last session, but to sort of orient members to items of a more sort of general statewide interest, a cursory overcap of items that would have been heard in Senate Education Policy or Finance Division last session. Secondly, as the chair mentioned, there were a few items that came to Education Conference Committee through House proposals that did become law but may not have had a thorough discussion in the Senate. And then thirdly, there were a few items that became law through actions of the Tax Conference Committee. And similarly, these items were not necessarily thoroughly discussed in education committees last year. So our goals are to answer questions you might have about these pieces and to sort of orient you to the landscape going forward through fiscal year 14. And beyond.
Mr. Chair, we have a handout. I believe everyone sees that. So, okay.
Mr. Chair and Madam Chair, as Bjorn mentioned, the two major spending areas came from the Chapter 116, the Education Act, which appropriated approximately $485 million, and then Chapter 143, the Tax Act, which appropriated another $120 million. The major spending item, the biggest spending item of that was the basic formula allowance increase, and that was effective fiscal year 14 and fiscal year 15. It was 1.45% each year, which amounted to $78 in fiscal year 14 and $80 in fiscal year 15. The total increase for both years amounts to approximately $238.2 million, so approximately close to half of the E-12 spending target. The other major change enacted in Chapter 116 was all-day kindergarten. The provision is effective in fiscal year 15 for a total biennial amount of approximately $133.9
million. Mr. Chair, Madam Chair, the next item on your slide deck is the student achievement levy. This levy is set statutorily at a total of $20 million statewide level. The levy is levied at a uniform rate in all districts. The sort of macro effect of changing the levy is to offset the required state appropriation. So, for example, if the levy were to be, through the actions of the legislature, increased in later years, this would have the net effect of reducing the state appropriation cost. Vice versa, if the levy were to be reduced, that would require additional state appropriations in general education. Next, there were a couple substantive changes to special education in addition to the increases in funding for special education. Beginning in fiscal year 15, unreimbursed special education costs will be shared between resident and serving districts. So under the current law, the resident district is responsible for covering that unreimbursed cost. This measure came to this committee from the governor's proposal as an effort to have some cost controls on special education costs. So the practical effect of this change is that a student with an IEP who open enrolls to a neighboring district or a charter school, the unreimbursed costs for that student will be partially borne by the serving district or the charter school. In the current and future years, special education funding will be based to some degree on sort of counts of pupils with certain disabilities. So these amounts are set in law. I won't go into great detail about this, but if you have questions about this, we're certainly available to answer questions. And if you happen to have your session books, you can read more about the specific disability categories and those amounts on page 1941 of the of Chapter 116.
Mr. Chair and Madam Chair, another area of change from Chapter 116 was career and technical revenue. Previously, the career and technical revenue was an all-levy program, and it reimbursed school districts up to 35% of approved expenditures on career and technical education. In Chapter 116, the major change was, there were two changes. One was to take it from an all-levy program and add an aid component, and $10 million was spent between fiscal year 14 and 15. In fiscal year 14, the cap was raised by $5.2 million in fiscal year 14, and then in fiscal year 15, the cap expires. Basically, it provides a mix of aid and levy to this program as well as additional spending.
Chair and Madam Chair, the achievement and integration revenue, this was a sort of both a fiscal change and a policy change. On the policy side, the provisions of the program, which you will recall were the program was repealed in a previous legislature. Some state aid was forecast for a replacement program. That program is rather substantially reformed in terms of its policy provisions, with a greater emphasis on student achievement as a requisite of the program. The funding structure creates more parity between demographically similar districts. So under the previous arrangement, you might have a district that was, in terms of student demographics, was very similar to a neighboring district, but the allowances per pupil would be somewhat different. Going forward, this funding is more even among similar districts. The district planning required by the program is very closely linked to the provisions of the world's best workforce, which was a House proposal that came to conference committee and ultimately became law. And on the next slide, Anne-Marie will give more attention to that. Lastly, under the new achievement and integration revenue, the commissioner has the authority to withhold some district revenue and, by the commissioner's direction, use that revenue at the district level to try and increase student achievement, increase the success of the program if the district should fail to meet the district's own goals.
Then going further into the world's best workforce, which came from the House bill, the World's Best Workforce directs school districts to have a plan to support and improve teaching and learning in the district, and it's aligned with creating the world's best workforce. So it's a combination of the following goals that are throughout the statutes. There's school readiness, literacy, closing the achievement gap, career and college readiness, and high school graduation rates. So the next provision is the early learning scholarships. And those are for low-income families of 3 and 4-year-olds, and it's an up to $5,000 scholarship for each eligible child per year, and they are required to be used in programs that participate in the quality rating and improvement system. And the total appropriation for the scholarships was $23 million each year, the biennium. And then the next provision is the staff development reserve, which was reinstated, and that's 2% of the basic formula revenue that districts are required to use for staff development. So that set aside in the previous biennium, and now it's back in, and we added a use for the teacher evaluation system that is coming on. And then we also did a lot with the redesigning of student assessments. And for this year's ninth graders, the assessment requirements will have to be the new assessment requirements. And that requires the commissioner to consult with the Chancellor of Minsku and then contract for a series of career and college readiness assessments in math, reading, and writing. And that series of assessments has to include a college placement diagnostic exam and contain career exploration elements. And then also, not at the high school level, but there's a requirement for computer adaptive reading and math assessments for grades 3 through 7, and that begins in the 2015-2016 school year.
Mr. Chair, Madam Chair, in Chapter 143, the tax omnibus bill, there were a few items related to E-12 education finance. Firstly, the location equity revenue. This was a House provision that came to Tax Conference Committee. It's sort of conceptually similar to a bill that was introduced in the Senate last year, Senate File 221 from Senator Bonhoff. The mechanics of how it works are slightly different, but the practical effect of it is that it delivers more revenue, equalized revenue, to metro area districts and districts in greater Minnesota that have greater than 2,000 students in membership. The metro area allowance is $424 per pupil. The greater Minnesota allowance is $212 per pupil. As I mentioned, the revenue line is equalized at a sort of middle tier. When you compare this equalization to referendum equalization, it's roughly equivalent to the middle equalization tier. as it happens, all but it's sort of an opt-in rather an opt-out program. So if the district chose not to accept this revenue and make this levy, they can opt out of the program. As it happens, two districts did opt out, Stillwater and Hermantown. All of the others who were eligible for the program will receive it as revenue for fiscal year 15. Next, the board-approved referendum. This was a provision in the tax omnibus bill from the Senate side of the table. This board-approved referendum allows local school boards to either convert up to $300 of existing referendum authority or to authorize new authority up to a total of $300 per pupil without voter approval. So there are, as we know, a number of districts throughout the state that have zero or less than $300 in referendum. With this provision in effect, those kinds of school boards would have the authority to make this levy without voter approval. And we'll have more detailed information available at a district-by-district level when the forecast data are released tomorrow. So I'll be working on that over the next couple of weeks. And if you have questions, invite you to contact our office. Next, referendum equalization. So this was also a Senate proposal at the Tax Conference Committee. It added a sort of lowest tier to referendum equalization. So corresponding with this first $300 that is now available to boards, this increment from zero to $300 on the referendum allowance is equalized more strongly, meaning total revenue, as you know, always equals a local levy plus whatever state aid would be contributed to the total revenue. So for the first $300 of referendum, in comparison to previous law, more state aid will be involved. So it's regardless of whether it's a conversion or a new authority. Lastly, the same law that repealed the previous integration program also repealed the integration levy authority. And the E-12 Finance Division last year had a levy target of zero. As it happens, the tax committee did reinstate that levy. It amounts to about 30% of the total integration revenue, roughly $30 million. This levy sort of retains all the qualities of the previous levy, meaning that for a few districts, the levy is forward shifted, so there's no sort of unwanted interruption in that arrangement. It carries forward as it had in previous years.
And finally, Mr. Chair and Madam Chair, we have the accelerated repayment of the school shifts. And so, as many of you know, Minnesota Statutes 16A.152 outlines the mechanism by which debts are repaid for the school shifts. Basically, there's an order that any positive unrestricted budgetary amount has to be paid. And it first goes to the budget, the cash flow account, the budget reserve, and then the school shifts. And in Chapter 116, there was a mechanism put in place that would accelerate the repayment of that shift. So typically at the end of the fiscal year, the money that was surplus would be carried forward to the November forecast. In this case, Chapter 116 accelerated that repayment. So basically the positive unrestricted budgetary balance was used to repay the school shifts. And so In October, MMB certified $636.1 million to be used to repay the school shifts, and the outstanding amount was estimated at $860.7 million. Based on that statute, the order is the aid payment first. So $291.5 was spent of that amount certified to eliminate the aid payment shift, and then an additional $344.6 million was spent to reduce the property tax recognition shift. So as it stands now, the aid payment shift has returned to the payment schedule of the 90-10 current year final year payment for school districts, and the property tax recognition shift has been reduced to $224.6 million, bringing the early recognition percentage to 23.1%. And one caveat in this is that this occurred in October, and so these numbers are dependent on that and could change given the forecast tomorrow. And the final thing I'd like to say is plug our fiscal review document that we published back in July. It has a lot more comprehensive information on all of the changes that were made in both Chapter 116 and 143, as well as the other areas regarding appropriations. So now I think we'll conclude here and open it up for any questions.
Thank you very much for the excellent overview. And members, any questions or comments? And certainly over the past six plus months since we passed this, that you've had some feedback from your districts, and hopefully it's been primarily positive, and I've found that to be the case. But comments, suggestions on what you've heard? Senator Jensen.
Thank you, Chair. I have a question on the location equity revenue section. You talked about there are two that opted out. How many districts then is it that opted in?
Mr. Chair, I haven't got that number right in front of me, but I will follow up by email to the committee with a number. It's possible that somebody from the department might know. Yeah, we'll get that number to you.
Okay, just a follow up.
Yes, Senator Jensen.
My question with my district, I have a school district that falls between the 1,000 pupil units and 2,000 pupil units that doesn't qualify for the disparity aid or for the location equity. Do we see a fix for that? I mean, can you comment on it at all and let me know if there's something that we're going to be able to do?
Mr. Chair and Senator Jensen, so the small schools, the top end of the small schools threshold is 1,000 pupils, and the lower end of the location equity revenue is 2,000 pupils. So
that's correct.
You are correct that school districts between 1,000 and 2,000 in average daily membership don't qualify for either program.
Okay.
But, Sarah Jensen, as you maybe indicated, there will be some proposals that would address that.
Okay, thank you.
Senator Johnson.
Again, mine are pretty technical, I think, questions. You talked about in the special education that the costs would be shared by the serving districts, and then you spoke also about similar disabilities being treated the same. Can you expand a little bit on that for me?
Mr. Chair and Senator, I'm going to open my book to the proper page and give you very accurate information here.
You tell me the page I can find.
So the language in question can be found in Laws 2013, Chapter 116, Article 5, Section 18. So,
thank you.
For example, what the law means by this sort of census-based reimbursement means that according to this section, a district would take account of the primary disability areas of autism spectrum disorders, developmental delay, and severely multiply impaired, and multiply that count by a fixed rate of $10,400, and that's how the special education aid would be calculated. So it's sort of known as a more census-based approach rather than an approach in previous years where the costs of that, the reimbursement for that wouldn't be so precisely prescribed by law.
Okay. Further questions? Senator Pratt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Wilms, just on the accelerated shift repayment, just a couple of questions. The acceleration, those were excess tax collections from the previous fiscal year that are now being applied to directed. As I recall, there was no additional funds allocated in the budget specifically for shift repayment. Is that correct?
That's, Mr. Chair and Senator Pratt, that's correct. The closing is the positive unrestricted budgetary balance after all of the receipts and expenditures are calculated. And so normally that positive restricted budgetary balance, if there had been any, would be carried forward to the November forecast. So you're right that there's no additional money there.
And then, Mr. Chairman, I have a So could you explain how the forecast released tomorrow will affect the money repaid to districts?
Mr. Chair and Senator Pratt, I'm not privy to the exact information of you know what the forecast will reveal, but the 90-10 payment schedule has been eliminated, so districts are at that original 90-10 payment schedule. So if there's additional money there, a portion of that, as outlined in that 16A section, will be, if there's another positive unrestricted budgetary balance, will be used again to pay back more property tax recognition shift.
Senator Pratt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a point of clarification. So what the money carried forward and promised to districts at the end of the fiscal year won't change. What we're talking about is simply excess tax collections between the beginning of the fiscal year and the November forecast. Now, is that what I'm trying to understand how the November forecast fits into this.
Sure. So the accelerated shift repayment deals with fiscal year 13 and the closing of books there. And so the November forecast will deal with looking outward and whether or not the projected estimates, if there's surplus money based on spending and receipts.
Senator Hall.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So just to clarify for myself, if the forecast comes out and it's a negative forecast, mm-hmm. Will the school shifts then be paid back?
Mr. Chair and committee members, yes. The money that has been allocated to repay the shift has already been paid. It's just when I mentioned whether or not something would change, it's just a matter of whether or not there would be additional dollars to use towards paying back. Does that answer?
And follow up?
Yes, Senator Hall.
The promised money to be paid back, when did we promise that? Was that this last year or prior to that?
Mr. Chair and Senator, I'm not sure I quite follow.
Well, the money that's paying back the school shift mm-hmm. was promised to be paid back.
Senator Hall, I believe a couple of years ago that there was that statutory commitment. It was accelerated during the most recent session. Further comments or questions? Well, at this point, we just wanted to get the overview. There's an excellent publication. We're going to get copies of that, perhaps a great holiday reading or a gift. we thank you for you, because you all have a part of it, one way or another, whether or not you support it. So we'll have that coming forward. Again, you'll get as we get that update tomorrow on the forecast and what the impact is, and keep sharing this with your districts. And thank you very much, staff, for that overview, and we'll look forward to that additional follow-up as we prepare for next session. Next on our agenda, we're going to get an update from the Department of Education. As I mentioned initially, we have several task forces that we charge the department to look into a number of areas of policy examination. And to give us an update, we have representatives from the department. I'll ask Deputy Commissioner Rose Hermanson to MC that effort.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Rose Hermanson, I'm assistant to the commissioner at the Department of Education. My job, almost immediately after session ended, was to put together all the task forces that you had enacted in legislation, and there were five of them, to be specific. You have before you two sheets of paper. One is basically our working schedule. I'll talk a little bit about that in a minute. And then the other one is the list of the task force members for each of the task forces. The reason I wanted to share the membership with you is to, so that you can see how wide and diverse the representation has been from throughout the state, and I'm going to talk a little bit about how the membership was decided. In some instances, it was dictated by statute. In other instances, it was through an open appointments process. You passed your legislation in the end of May. In June, we started the process of developing membership for each of the task forces. Each of the task forces' membership is set up in a different way. Specifically, the five task forces were Career Pathways and Technical Education, School Facilities Financing Working Group, and that's technically not a task force, but it's operating the same way, Special Education Caseloads, and as we get to that one, they really had two charges. You had a Standard Adult High School Diploma Task Force, and then finally at Minnesota Teacher Licensure Advisory Task Force. I have with me today co-chair. We appointed co-chairs for each of the task force except for the one, the Standard Adult Diploma. One of the co-chairs for each of the task force is with me today, and I'm going to let them fill you in a little bit about the discussions taking place, some of the detailed and subject matter. I'm going to talk a little more about the process, and I'll fill in any details they may or may not get to as they lay out what the membership has been doing. Letters were sent out in I must admit the process of pulling the membership together got a little complicated because in some instances you had very specific organizations named. So our first task was to contact each of those organizations and ask them to submit a member for the task force based on what the direction was. We then spent the month of July and first part of August, we had to go through the open appointments process for other individuals, and that process did not complete. We went to the Secretary of State's office and had applications submitted to us. Fundamentally, that ended on August 2nd, and then we started most of our task force meetings in August, the month of August. The charges, and I'm going to go through these off of this sheet, the one-pager. The Career Pathways Task Force was charged to make recommendations on how to structurally redesign secondary and post-secondary education and bring them to the legislature. Now, this is a fairly huge challenge. And if you look a little more in detail at what was further laid out in the law, there were some specifics, and I think this task force has been working extremely hard trying to figure out how to do this, and I'll let Richard talk a little bit more about it. You want us to improve secondary and post-secondary outcomes for students and adult learners. You want us to align secondary and post-secondary education programs serving students and adult learners. And you ask that we align these programs to meet workforce needs. And then finally, you want us to analyze the effect of this. And so we've had this task force in particular spent quite a bit of time getting background information so that we're all working off the same page. That was a large task force, 21 members, and I'll let Richard in a minute tell you kind of what's gone on there. School Facilities Financing Work Group, another task force. I have Mark Bollinger, who is our co-chair on that from Minneapolis Public Schools, with us today. That task force was all, as a work group, was all appointed by organizations, and so you didn't tell us a number. So we took three members from school boards, three superintendents appointed by MASA, three school business managers, and three school facilities directors. Those were dictated in statute. We asked those organizations to send us recommendations, and we pulled three members, and then the commissioner appointed three. They've been working at and looking at how we finance our school buildings and what the needs are out there. We're currently in the process of getting a survey back also on what the impact of the early learning programs may have on the school facilities' needs. The Special Education Caseloads Task Force, Don McNeil is one of the co-chairs here, is with us today. You said at least 10 members. This one had to all go through the open appointments process. And these members were supposed to be equally representative of advocates and of practitioners. And so when we looked through the open appointments process, we had to make sure we were doing that equally. The Standard Adult High School Diploma one, you name 9 members per statute, so we asked for those appointments. And the same with teacher licensure. Primarily, these were all identified in statute, so we had to wait for the recommendations to come in from those organizations. The task force has been very busy. The basic thing we started out with all of them is spending a meeting discussing their charge, and then finding out what kind of information they felt they needed to have in order to do their work. And this wasn't all done at the first meeting, but we wanted a sense of what information those task force members wanted in order to meet the charge that you had given them. And so much of our first meeting or meetings was developing foundations so we were all working from the same page. Then right now, what the groups selected their co-chairs. The groups also then started the process of looking at what kind of recommendations, what kind of information they would need to develop and put some meat to the recommendations. We are right in that. We're right in the throes of that right now with most task force. There's 2 that are a little further along, but 3 of the 5 are very much into the meat of making these decisions, and our December meetings, we have 1 tomorrow, we have 4 next week, and then we come back again in January and see all of our meeting dates are on here as well. I also have put a link to the department website, so if you want to see any and all of the materials we've looked at, you're certainly welcome to just go online, because everything that's been handed out is there on the website, including some of our internal working documents. So there's volumes of paper. I didn't want to bring them all, but I did want to let you know, kind of give you an overview of what the group has been doing, how the membership has been put together, and we expect to be on time and have all the reports to the legislature as required. In some instances, the teacher licensure task force, we were asked to put that together with the Board of Teaching. We had a little glitch there in that the executive secretary of the Board of Teaching took a different job after our second meeting, and so much of the work there has fallen to the department. However, the co-chair of that task force is the chair of the Board of Teaching, so we've tried to work in partnership. Almost all of the members of the task force have been with us throughout. We've had a couple of changeovers because of job changes for members, but the task forces have been pretty much intact from the first meeting, and they've done an excellent job. With that, I'm going to report on the adult diploma one at the end. I'm first going to turn it over to Richard Rosovich, who is the co-chair of Career Pathways, and he's here to tell you kind of what they've been doing and answer any questions you might have. Richard?
Welcome.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, Madam Chair, my name is Richard Rosovac. I'm a National Board Certified Teacher at Irondale High School, where I teach AP European History, and I also teach our early college seminar class. This year, I've also been released part-time to work with our middle schools in aligning the middle school and high schools around the early college program. I'd like to thank you very much for the opportunity to provide you with an update on the work of the task force. We've had several very productive meetings and begun to work through nearly 70 different recommendations from task members. Although our final report is still very much a work in progress, we have identified some areas that look promising. I'd like to introduce them briefly to you and then just give you plenty of time for questions if you have them. The general areas of interest that have emerged are, first, enhancing guidance and counseling about career pathways so it becomes more effective and useful to students, their parents, and guardians. Providing more clarity related to the products and portability of student planning documentation. Effective marketing of career and technical education programs, providing experiential learning opportunities for students, professional development for K-12 teachers and counselors, leading to a stronger understanding of what it means for students to be career ready, enhancing collaboration between K-12 teachers and higher education faculty members, providing greater flexibility in the design of school structures, instructional delivery models, and funding to allow for increased participation in college, career, and technical education classes. Finally, designing effective instructional institutional structures to align workforce needs, educational programming, and career guidance. Thank you.
Thank you. Perhaps we'll take questions on each task force after the summary. So comments, questions from members on this task force. And I recall we've had some presentations on Irondale as well, and so we know the great success you've had there and appreciate your sharing. Senator Clausen.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. I was very pleased to see you have guidance and counseling and also student planning guides. I know some districts have gone to the career pathway guidebooks, and I think it spells out for students and parents very clearly on the courses students should be taking, what types of activities they should be involved in. One question, as a former high school principal myself, over the years, we used to have career courses that were actually requirements for students. We've really gone away from that. Has your committee discussed at all requirements or reinstating career courses for students where they actually take a course that really hones in on the career pathways for them versus relying upon guidance and counseling? We know we've got a very poor ratio to students in the state, and I know it's you're really pressuring that group of people to do career counseling when they have so many other issues that they're dealing with.
Mr. Chairman, yes. Senator, we have had discussions about which kinds of instructional models would best fit for different educational settings. And so one of the continuing discussions that we're having now are about whether or not we should specify or recommend to you particular models like an individual class, or whether or not we should establish some recommendations for criteria for programs that would be comprehensive career and college readiness, and then allow districts more flexibility about how to meet those particular guidelines. So that is certainly part of the discussion that we're having.
Thank you.
And Mr. Chair, I'd like to thank Senator Clausen. He did speak to our group at our last meeting and shared some of the evidently him and Senator Bonhoeff have been around the state talking to higher ed folks, and we invited him to share what they have heard as they've gone around the state. So it was very helpful to our committee.
Further comments or questions? I had a question. One of our state goals under World's Best Workforce, college career readiness. Will we have a clear definition, expectation that's measurable, attainable for what we mean by career readiness?
Mr. Chairman, that is one of the things that perhaps Rose can talk about. It's also being discussed in various assessments that we're looking at, and I know that that's work that we've had presentations on in terms of helping us understand how to measure that. We've also had presentations on the SLEDS database, data sets, and understanding.
For everyone, for the, I believe it's being recorded, SLEDS, Statewide Longitudinal Educational Data.
Data
system.
Sets, yep, and the connections that the Department of DEED, yes, I'm sorry, I don't remember the acronym for that one there, DEED, connections between higher education, DEED, and K-12 about how to really measure long-term outcomes for students, and I think that accountability piece is something that we're taking into effect as those data sets are developed and further implemented.
And Mr. Chair, I would just add, you know, blending systems and then blending workforce is not an easy task because there's a lot of, you know, we have people on this committee that were appointed by their organizations. And so now we're at the point of saying, okay, how can we break down some of these walls and figure out what's going to be best in serving students and all students, all types of students? And this has been a deep discussion of the group. Not all kids are going to necessarily go into college, or there are very high-paying, good-quality jobs out there in certain fields that go unmet. And so how do we develop pathways for all kids to be successful and actually, you know, going back to school and being successful and returning to school and being successful? And it is a big challenge. The Career and College Ready, we do have other groups working on that. The World's Best Workforce, we are trying to, each district will set goals. And I think part of our goal here is to have them set goals that align with some of the recommendations come out, that every student will have either a class or a counselor or someone to help guide them through their planning. Now, so that's going to be a challenge to the districts to work with recommendations and implement it as part of their World's Best Workforce goal setting.
Mr. Chair, I'd just like to add very briefly, I think also that one of the ways that we'll get to from a practitioner's point of view, one of the ways we get to a much better understanding of what it means to be college and career ready is through increased collaboration with our colleagues in higher education. And I think that as we look at extending partnerships and I think some of the new work that Chancellor Rosenstone's done is going to help align the K-12 and the Minnesota State College University system much more effectively. And that is also, just to give you an idea, there are many, many good practices that are underway and many things that are currently in development. And so part of the work of our task force has been to understand where those practices are most promising and to try to figure out if there are ways to scale those up as opposed to just continuing pilot programs. That's also part of the discussion we're having. But I think that we're going to get to a really good understanding of that.
And will the report include a fiscal note or as to what implementation might cost if we looked at the various suggestions?
Mr. Chair, at this point, we haven't talked about the fiscal implications. I've basically just encouraged them to think about how to get this implement, you know, what we could do to implement something, and I guess I'll have our department staff look at what might end up being some of the costs. Counselors cost money. However, there have been several suggestions in relation to using some employment counselors or working across agencies with DEED. There may be more than one way of doing it, and so until we get our recommendations on board, it may be a little hard to put some money or decide how much it's going to cost.
Senator Torres-Ray.
Thank you. My apologies. I had to step out for a second, and I really wanted to hear the entire presentation. But we had a recent meeting with both Commissioner Casillas and Director Poggi Miller to really talk about what is that we need to do to better train our teachers and figure out how to offer opportunities to recruit talented students. And we have been reviewing some statistics about really the challenge that we face in Minnesota, because students just don't want to pursue the teaching profession. They don't feel like there are enough incentives. And one of the questions or one of the reviews that we did, this was Monday, was really look at the type of skill that is necessary for the teaching in those grades, that the technology, the amount of, you know, information that is available to kids, the amount of really broad choices that are being now offered to kids through media and online information that is available to them, and teachers are having to really catch up, and they really don't have enough support available to them. Have you had a discussion about what is that we need to do as a state to really stay on track with the future of education as we try to connect with higher education, and how do we do this with high school? Have you had any discussions as to what you need to bring to us in terms of really assessing the status of the training of teachers in high school, and how do we do that, and what's the cost of doing that?
Mr. Chair, Senator, We haven't really delved into, we have had some discussion about teachers. In fact, one of the task force members has said that we maybe should be going toward having a master's degree for all high school instructors. And part of the push there was so that there would be this more alignment with the college-level instruction so that you can go back and forth more readily in providing or blended teaching or team teaching or whatever. As to the actual credentialing or the requirements, I don't think we spent a lot of time in this committee talking about the teaching skills and how we recruit teachers. Actually, a couple of my other task forces, we spent a little more time talking about the need for teachers and the shortages that are out there. But we have not dealt in great depth with about the teacher preparation part.
Mr. Rosevic, as a highly effective teacher, I'm sure you have some thoughts.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, Madam Chair. Again, from my personal perspective as a practitioner, certainly in my AP course, which is a college-level course, I have a blended instruction model that I'm using, and that's something that was self-taught. I know that professional development for teachers is a matter we have talked about, and there's a great recognition that for practicing teachers to be able to effectively communicate with students about career pathways, we do need to look at enhanced professional development for those teachers and for counselors so that we're able to do that more effectively. So there's a broad recognition that that's an area that we need to do some growing in. I think you've raised some wonderful kinds of questions about the future of teaching, and I can tell you as a teacher I'm incredibly proud to be a teacher. I'm very, very happy to do this. I've been twice certified nationally, and I would recommend it to anyone as a career because it's so fulfilling and rewarding. But it does continue to be challenging, and I'm not quite sure where all of those answers will come from, but I know that there's a great commitment to find answers to those problems.
Congratulations on the national certification.
Thank you.
Senator Johnson.
Mr. Chair and whoever cares to respond, in your task force, have you looked at the difference between the programs that might work in metropolitan area as opposed to those in comparison to those in rural areas? What makes me think about that right now is that Senator Torres Rey just mentioned about, you know, internet and high tech and so forth. And I think in today's newspaper there was an article about the economy is really in Minnesota is really being held up by what's going on in the metropolitan area. And they talked about the need for better internet access in the rural areas, that they don't have, they can't use the technology that's available because they don't have access to high-speed internet and so forth. Have you talked about that, and what do they do? What are you going to do when you say you want everybody to be up to snuff and there isn't an internet connection that will work in some areas?
Mr. Chair, Madam Chair, I would like to just start off by saying that when we've had the discussions, we've really been driven by an equity lens. And so what that means is when we're having discussions about students with disabilities, we want to make sure that they have access to and success in our college and career programs. We also use that to examine the impact statewide. So we want the programs and the recommendations that we're making to be effective both in the metro and to be effective in greater Minnesota. We're very fortunate to have, as Rose mentioned, representatives from around the state. And so there's a constant reflection on what are the kinds of tools that students will need in terms of plans and portability, and how are we going to best be able to deliver instruction in places where a state college or university faculty member might not be readily available. So it is certainly part of the conversation, and I think it's important to remember that that is driven by the feeling that we need to make these things successful for all of our students in Minnesota.
We have time for one more question on this segment. Senator Kent.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
As we'll get back if there's after the other task forces.
As we're talking about this topic of career and college readiness, I keep coming back to ready for what? And from a data perspective, the old Wayne Gretzky thing of skating to where the puck is going to be. in this really comprehensive challenge that this task force is facing, is there enough attention to the research and the projections and the data? I say this as a parent of a seventh grader. You know, what the workforce needs are going to be in 5 years are a little irrelevant to his life. Are we doing enough on the long-term research and planning? Is that part of the discussion of this task force to make sure we're identifying what we're preparing our kids for?
Mr. Chair, yes. We received early reports on that, and that is part of the system is as well being mindful that we want to provide counseling and information in a way that's not static, but that's flexible enough to respond to future workforce needs and to make sure that the various stakeholders who have that information or producing that data are regularly engaged in the conversations.
Thank you.
We'll squeeze one more quick question. Senator Clausen.
Thank you. I was reminded as we were talking about career education that up in Virginia, the Workforce Center is involved in a pilot with a high school there. And I maybe just it sounds like you've already aware of that, but that might be a good pilot to take a look at as far as replicating that across the state. Thanks.
Thank you. And thank you, Mr. Moskvich.
Mr. Chair, we're going to have our special ed task force chair go next. He's an attorney, and I think I want to get him back to his office. So.
Very good.
I'm not sure.
Welcome.
I'll get back.
Mr. McGill.
Good morning. May I?
Yes.
Mr. Chair, Madam Chair, my name is Don McNeil. I am an attorney. I'm managing partner of my law firm in Minneapolis. I am also a father of three children. The first one with Williams syndrome that is 24. Williams, if you're not familiar with it, is like Downs, but not really. She has an IQ in the mid-50s. She is a success story of Minnesota special ed. She still lives at home, but takes Metro Mobility to Blue Cross every morning and works there assembling materials for their training courses. I have a 20-year-old who's a typical child but an excellent student who is at Carleton College now. And we have a 16-year-old with classic autism. Classic autism, I use that term because that is one you do not need a doctor to diagnose. He does not talk. He does not wear clothes. He's a handful. He needs 24/7 care, cannot be left alone at any time. He'll elope, as we put it in our language, which means the doors are locked at our house, not to keep out intruders, but to keep him from leaving in the cold. I have obviously been active within the disability community, and that's how I was, I believe, selected to be on this task force. This task force is focused on three areas from the charge from the Department of Education. It is focusing on a regulation that sets forth the maximum number of children receiving special education services in a classroom, which would include a teacher plus a paraprofessional. Our second charge is looking for other recommendations that we can make to make the jobs of the teachers easier, but also cost-effective. And third is to align the statutes and regulations where there have been inconsistencies identified in the legislative auditor's report published earlier this year. We have broken our task force into two committees. I am chairing the subcommittee on aligning the statutes and regulations where there have been identified inconsistencies. Todd Travis, who is the Director of Special Education for the Midwest Special Education Cooperative in the Morris area, is chairing the caseload side. I can report that we have made quick order of aligning the statutes and regulations in our first meeting, and I can give an example. In our state statute, we require transition planning for a child with special education to begin that process in ninth grade. Our regulation says it's to begin at ninth grade or age 14, whichever comes first. We've quickly identified that inconsistency. I believe my committee will be making a recommendation to have the regulation changed to align with what the statute provides. It's not particularly anything of a cost saving, but it removes some confusion for those that are in that field and have to answer that question every time it comes up. Which one do we have to go by? The second committee that Mr. Travis is chairing is focusing on caseload. Caseload is the term that's used in regulation. That is different than the word workload. However, we have used our second charge, allowing us to look for some cost-effective areas to make recommendations to also address workload. We are in the midst of identifying what constitutes workload for a teacher and trying to find ways to make it more efficient, more effective, and more cost-effective. Today we'll be reporting into Ms. Hermanson with some, after we've caucused with people we have spoken to, we're giving some written ideas. We're going to post that on the board next Tuesday when we get together again and go through them as a committee and as a task force committee and see what we can come up with and start gelling around a recommendation for this committee. Our task force is scheduled to meet two more times, and I expect that we will be able to reach a consensus with some recommendations on time and have a report for this committee by the date of our deadline of February 15th. I'm happy to answer any other questions that the committee might have.
Thank you. Mr. McNeil, questions, comments? Senator Pratt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. McNeil, you talked about your two subcommittees aligning rules with statutes and caseloads. Being a former school board member and serving on the Minnesota River Valley Special Ed Co-op, one of the things that I was wondering if your task force is taking on is looking at whether or not statute provides the right educational opportunities for our students, and does that fall into one of the either into your mission or one of your two task force?
Mr. McKinney.
Mr. Chair, Senator, I think the answer is that is something that gets discussed, because I think there is a universal motivation with our diverse membership of our task force that we're all looking to do the same thing. We're trying to help each child reach their full potential, whatever that's going to be, and trying to find ways to get there. We have educators on the committee that have come to us and identified issues that they think make their jobs more difficult. The legislative auditor's report identified some areas as they interviewed people. We've tried to be deliberate in our analysis and look for what those particular issues are. And I had the opportunity to also serve on the 2009 task force to analyze the federal versus state regulations and see where they might exceed and we can make some efficiencies. And from that background, I know that this is complex, but one of the things that we have been hungry for, and we compliment the department for assisting us, is looking for information that would help us find the way to let each child reach their full potential, but also look for the inefficiencies and then quantify what's the cost. If I can give you one example, the prior written notification, we actually, in our state regulation, require a little bit more information than the federal rule does. Does that make us more inefficient? We haven't quantified that, so it's difficult to come back and say that's what's driving costs for special education. Is it preventing us from getting the kid to the full potential? I don't think so, but those are the type of issues that we're trying to address.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. McNeil, thanks for that. I just want to make sure that when we start looking at, and I understand that this task force is focused on caseloads, but making sure that we're being innovative in the services and how we deliver those services, as well as just managing the caseload within the current structure. And I guess maybe that was more of the direction Wall Street Journal and a number of publications have talked about alternative delivery methods and school options, and I wonder if there's statutory or regulatory prohibitions that we need to be looking at as well to make sure that we're being innovative and thinking of outside of the current structure.
Mr. Chair and Senator, there's two or three things going on here at the same time, which we had to kind of ground the task force in. You heard earlier we are going to have a new special ed funding formula. We talked a little bit about the cross-subsidy and what drives costs, and we did so they had that background, so they knew if they're making recommendations, we got something else happening as we go to a new funding methodology. Also, we had a brief report. Evidently, the feds are going to be changing their expectations, and theirs is going to be more based on outcomes rather than inputs. And we had going to hopefully have a little more information before we finish about what that might look like. In other words, the accountability measures may look different down the road, and so we have to be conscious of that. I think the bottom line for most of the task force members is they want to be spending more time with the students and less time on some of the auxiliary activities. We had a presentation also on paperwork, and the department has another group looking at paperwork reduction. I think if there's one theme that runs through all of this is they almost everybody says, is there some way that we can be more efficient technologically or whatever with all the paperwork requirements so that we can be spending more time with the students and perhaps coming up with some more innovative delivery models as well. So,
thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much, Mr. McNeil. Ed?
Our next task force is our school. It's actually our school facilities work group. Here we had the four different groups, and this has been kind of an interesting task force. I'll let Mr. Bollinger from Minneapolis Public Schools, he's one of the co-chairs. Our other co-chair is from Moose Lake, and we decided today that we'd bring in the people that were closest to the capital, and so Mr. Bollinger got the nod here.
Absolutely.
Okay, welcome.
Mr. Chair, Madam Chair, and Senators, good morning. I am Mark Bollinger. I am from Minneapolis Public Schools, but I am here to represent a working group and express to you what I'm hearing from them and the direction that we're going. First of all, let me say that we have a very nice cross-section in our working group, as you can see by the paperwork in front of you. And that relates then to understanding that every school district has a different personality and different needs. So first, we appreciate the opportunity to participate and to be heard. I heard a very passionate group talk about many things, especially about providing safe and inviting environment. And while we want to support, encourage, and provide new enhanced opportunities for our students, we are focusing in a little bit on the school facilities and their great need in maintenance, repairs, and restoration. Our buildings have a lot of needs. This isn't just a Minnesota thing. This is a national thing. And while we would like to update, upgrade, add, things like that, we believe we need to take care of the base items first. And just wanted to make sure that the state understood that we remain cognizant of the state's role and position and the economic situation it is today, but we still look forward to the future and want to make sure that we're giving the right kind of support to the students and to the teachers trying to educate our students. One of the items that we are looking at is reforming the review and comment process. We'd like to streamline, update that, focusing in making sure that focuses on capital improvement projects. So by increasing a threshold that triggers what projects are being reviewed, we feel like that we can streamline the whole process itself, adding no additional cost to the state, reducing workloads, and increasing response times from MDE, and as a possible cost savings to the taxpayers and the districts in the preparation and reports that are required in that. This does, and I think what you'll see is one of the outcomes does supports and advances local controlling authority for these pieces back to the local school districts and school boards. One of the big pieces that we heard was that there are 25 school districts that do qualify for alternative facilities levy and bond. Those districts self-govern how much they bond for, what their levy rates are every year. But the rest of the school districts felt like they are being a bit handcuffed and trying to get their job done, especially on renewal, deferred maintenance, and things like that, because they are under a deferred maintenance process. And what we're taking a hard look at is trying to blend the two programs together, the alt facilities program and the deferred maintenance program, and developing a new, program that we'd like to recommend that will cause no harm to the 25 school districts, but give new opportunities to the remaining school districts in this state to take care of the building, the existing assets that they have right now.
So part of that in that is we want to make sure that the state understands we haven't forgotten charter schools. And when we talk about school districts, they are part of this. And we are taking a hard look at our early learner program and process that we'd like to know. We have two more meetings that will take us through January with a potential of a third. And we will have a recommendation at the end of January and support the commission as she brings that to the state. Open for questions.
Thank you, Mr.
Bollinger. I'd also like to add that one of the things that this one will probably have some price tag at some point, you know, not on the review and comment side, but if we look at, I think what we're trying to do is make the recommendations, make the funding streams more equitable. So some districts feel other districts have an advantage. Some have to go to the voters, some don't have to go to the voters. So we also want to look at equalizing. So we will have a fairly in-depth look at the equity in a couple of ways, having access in one and also in equalizing funding in some ways. A third area that they've kind of looked at is also what to do about those unique situations such as tornadoes, floods, et cetera, which always require either special action or whatever. Is there a way of having a program that would help us deal more readily with certain situations that may arrive unexpectedly? So there's a variety of issues that this task force hopes to bring recommendations. We're going to develop a core set of principles and then have some, we hope, unanimous recommendations from the committee members.
Thank you. Questions, comments? Senator Clausen.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Are you also looking at the health and safety levy and the guidelines for the use of those funds as part of your study?
Mr. Chair and Senator, we're looking at seeing if we can streamline so we don't have several different funding streams and give school districts greater flexibility. Because this district may need more in health and safety. This may need to just fix the roofs. I mean, I guess you could say that's health and safety, but we tend to have several different funding streams and kind of put them in pockets, and we're looking at, is there a way of streamlining this, giving greater flexibility to the school districts and let them decide what their facilities needs are with some oversight from the department?
I know in talking to education colleagues, that's been a sore spot as far as those guidelines and the limitations that school districts can use those funds. So I'm glad to hear you're looking at expanding that. Thank you.
Additional questions, comments? And I know a number of you have had proposals and, you know, on behalf of your local school districts recognizing needs. And I know this task force is taking a very comprehensive long-term look. We're looking at a significant investment, but it's to get the job done. It's to provide more equity in the system overall. So I do know there's a great deal of interest throughout the state on this.
Mr. Chair, I might add that Senator Stump did sit through two or three of our meetings at the beginning, in particular as in his position as the chair of the bonding committee. He wanted to see what kind of overlap there might be.
Good. Thank you.
Our next task force is the one dealing with teacher licensure. In particular, we're dealing with the issues that arose in the last session about the basic skills test. And I have Christopher Smith here, who is one of the co-chairs on that committee.
Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Madam Chair. My name is Dr. Christopher Smith. I'm a professor at Augsburg College and co-chair of this task force. Up to this point, we've been mostly doing fact gathering and hearing from as many stakeholders as possible. All the sessions so far, we've had several people come in and speak and sort of share their perspective on this issue. I think one of the most productive meetings that we had, however, was at an open meeting at the Education Minnesota Conference, where we invited anybody who was interested in the issue to come in and speak. And I think we gathered a lot of very important, very personal, very heartfelt information and got to see the issue on a very personal level. One of the big issues that we keep coming back to as a task force is trying to understand, this is a basic skills assessment, but what do we mean by basic skills? Trying to define that term and what that means and how universal might it be for all of our teachers. In kind of unpacking that term, we've seen a lot of different strata kind of break out from this. So we have students that are attempting to take the tests and are not able to take to pass the assessment. But we also have immersion teachers who are non-native English speakers. We have all sorts of inequities potentially within urban versus rural, social economic status. So there's a lot to sort of unpack in what we mean by basic skills. Even on a more fundamental level, what's basic for elementary versus secondary versus special ed? It's an awfully broad brush, and we're trying to dissect that brush as carefully as we can. We're also considering the portability of the exam, what this means for the importing and exporting of teachers in and out of Minnesota, and how this may impact meeting the supply and demand needs for teachers in Minnesota. So actually, we're meeting tomorrow, and we're going to be starting more of the recommendation stage. We've already started to pull together various ideas from the various committee members, everything ranging from status quo to complete 180 and everything in between. And while a lot of those recommendations may not be necessarily viable, I think it's important that we consider all the possibilities and that we be as exhaustive as we can in this process. We're also considering recommendations that are short-term and long-term solutions. So the current contract that we have runs through 2015, so there's a certain limit as to what we can do necessarily. So we're looking at things to do in the now as well as to inform potentially the next RFP. So when we meet tomorrow, we'll start to boil down some of these recommendations that we have. We've got pages and pages and pages of recommendations. I'm a little skeptical that we'll reach a unanimous decision as for our recommendation, but I'm very optimistic we'll be able to reach a consensus well in advance of our mid-February deadline. If you have any questions, feel free to entertain them.
Questions? Obviously, there's been a great deal of discussion by the policy and other committees on this, but Senator Spring.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Dr. Smith, I have several questions because this is an area that I have been working on for quite some time, but not just related to the actual license per se, but really how do we take a look at what are we doing with teachers in the state of Minnesota today? And I want to give a little perspective in here because I want my committee to really review this carefully, and I would like to ask the commissioner and deputy commissioner to help me put some numbers together to really understand how this works. Members, the United States ranked 17 in the testing that we did, that the several countries participated in doing this testing on math, reading, and science of 15-year-olds, and we ranked 17 in reading and 26 in math. But one of the analyses that was provided recently by academia is that one of the reasons for why U.S. is ranking behind is because we have put a tremendous emphasis on measuring education through accountability. And we talk about these measures of accountability based on labor markets. And we also want to do much more than we used to do in the past with less resources. So appreciative inquiry, science, and pedagogy is not part of the conversation that takes place in the U.S. any longer because we are guided by other principles. I'm very intrigued by that. And the reason I want to tie this into teacher preparation is because I believe very strongly that we have gone way too far and removing resources and removing this appreciative inquiry conversation from pedagogy, from the classroom, from not just the classroom where we teach kids, but also the classroom that prepares teachers. So that if we don't bring that conversation back, we can keep testing kids and teachers and senators and everybody who want to be tested in the education field. But we're just not going to get there. So I want to ask you if the task force has had this conversation, because the license is really just it's a product, right? It's something that gives you that ability. It's a paper that says, okay, you're here now. But we don't have the actual infrastructure to give us the kind of quality and the training that we need for the future. So how do we get to have people with licenses or not licenses? To me, that's irrelevant if we don't have the investment that we need. Is the task force talking about it?
You want to do it, sir? Well, I think that's a Mr. Chair or Madam Chair, I believe that's a somewhat larger issue than what the task force is geared toward. It's a very important one, and one that certainly has come up. I think what you're addressing is a question of teacher effectiveness, and what we're looking at is a test of basic skills. And it's been a philosophical challenge for us to sort of separate those two issues. There is an assessment that prospective teachers take in order to gain licensure, which is specifically a pedagogy test. At no point has that ever been disputed as an assessment. That seems to be an assessment that most of the students that come out of our IHEs don't have a problem passing. So there's a sense that the knowledge of how to teach, the science and art of teaching, is not at issue. What's at issue with the MTLE is this quote-unquote basic skills test, the fundamentals of whatever fundamentals come to mean of reading and writing and of mathematics. So what you're addressing, like I said, is very much a concern, but it's not really something that's measured through this assessment, if that makes sense.
It makes total sense, and this is what I'm bringing this to the attention of the members today and to the staff and to the members of the task force, because I believe that if we don't have this more profound conversation, we are going to keep talking about this, I don't know for how long. And that's just really not where the conversation should be. The conversation needs to be about how are we preparing, how are we recruiting, how are we diversifying, and if we need master's degrees for high school students, that's where we need to go, and we need to offer the incentives to get our students to get there and provide the resources so that students can pursue a master's degree to be teachers in high schools in Minnesota. So I want to tell you, members, and the public, to me this is a fundamental question, and it's a fundamental belief that we really need to wrestle with. And I am unwilling to go into producing some kind of quick legislation that pacifies the political division around this issue. It is wrong, and I don't think we should do it. It is not about the future of the profession. It is not about the future of our students. It is just, you know, really responding to political pressures that are just simply, in my view, not long-term solutions for the state.
If I may respond.
Dr. Smith.
Mr. Chair, Madam Chair, I think to steal something from Senator Kent's analogy, on a personal level, not speaking for the task force necessarily, I do feel there may be a sense that we're assessing where we were rather than where we are going. And I think that the Minnesota that I see and that I like to see, one that shows a lot of growth in diversity and a lot of growth in multiculturalism, may be impaired by this assessment. And again, that's speaking on my behalf, not on behalf of the task force, but that's something that I do wrestle with and I do concern. So I do see a certain intersection between how this basic skills assessment can work against the diversification of pedagogy that you're addressing. If this assessment does serve, and statistically it does seem to serve, as some sort of roadblock to the diversification of teachers in Minnesota, then that is very much a concern. Absolutely.
And Mr. Chair and Senator Tarz Ray, I don't think there's many people on the task force that wouldn't agree with you. We looked at our specific charge, which was to make recommendations on requirements for teacher applicants to demonstrate mastery of reading, writing, and math skills, and for an alternative licensure pathway for non-English speaking candidates seeking licensure in a language immersion. We had a pretty narrow task. However, the discussions have been fairly rich about along the lines of what makes a good teacher and what things should we be doing instead. Tomorrow, the task force members will have big sheets up on the wall, and one of the sheets will say, eliminate the test and replace with, okay? The other one will be, keep the test but make these changes. Now, we have a contract, which Dr. Smith talked about, That goes through 2015, and the company that the contract with has been very involved in monitoring what's going on. But I think the fundamental issue between the task force is, do we keep the tests or do we eliminate it? And if we eliminate it, replace it with what? And I think what you're getting to is, what should be the criteria that we use to determine what makes an effective teacher, not just on one assessment, although that's basically what our charge has been, but what should we be doing in the whole area of teacher preparation? Are they residency programs? Should we be having more entry requirements? In other words, being more selective about who gets in the program? I think a lot of this has been part of our discussion, but it's not necessarily directly part of our charge. And I'm sure the task force members would love to be involved in kind of enhancing what we should be doing in the area of teacher development and licensure.
Thank you for your efforts, sir. Further comments, questions? Senator Claussen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This may be a redundant question just based upon your comments, but has the committee looked at all at tiered licensure, and has the committee looked at the amount of time that a prospective teacher actually spends in the classroom?
Mr. Chair, Senator Claussen, there was a tiered licensure task force about 3 years ago, I think, and they had fairly extensive discussions, and I think they submitted a report to the legislature. I can't recall. I know there was a lot of division on that task force about the value and how to do it. But at this point I can't recall specifically what the recommendations, but we haven't really talked about tiered licensure. We've talked about there are some unique situations, especially in greater Minnesota, where they have difficulty getting teachers. I think the feeling is we have way too many teachers on variances and with community expert licenses, and a lot of this is supply and demand. If you talk to the special ed task force, one of the big issues we've had and part of the reason behind the workload is we can't get qualified special ed teachers. And so what you do is you ask a teacher who's qualified in one area to kind of cover a special ed student's needs in another area, and they haven't got the training and background. It's a matter of necessity, however, because they want someone working with that child, especially if you go in a more rural part of the state and they don't have the applicants. I had someone tell me over the weekend there are teacher aides in special ed classes, and none of the teachers, these teachers' aides are working with. This is over Thanksgiving dinner now, by the way, are working with teachers who are licensed in the field of the kids that they're working with. But the district really has no other option because they can't get them. And so we have teacher licensure issues in a variety of ways. The immersion teachers, the stories we heard from them was unbelievable. This stuff gets tied in with their ability to get a visa. They're being recruited to come to these countries. And some of these teachers have had experience, 10 or 15 years teaching experience in two or three other countries in their languages. They come here, they're on a visa. In order to keep their visa, they have to have their licensure in place. They have to pay for their license, they have to pay for the test, and they have to pay for their visa, and because they're not citizens, they have to do it all in cash. There are some economic situations we're creating that we got a lot of great information from the candidates, and I think we have to take it to heart and figure out how to make the system work a little better.
Yeah. Just a follow-up to support what you said. I recently had a conversation with a teacher who was native Spanish-speaking from South America, and the test that were required for those Spanish-speaking people and to teach Spanish here in the United States, there were questions on there asking who – she's from Colombia. She was asked, who's the current president of Bolivia? It seems to me that we need to take a good look at some of those test questions as well.
And Mr. Chair, Senator, we had that same comment made at this listening. We had a whole listening session at the convention, and I invite anybody in that wanted to come. And an example, they said the tests, they were concerned about bias. And I said, well, can you give me an example? Because I've heard this. And the example they gave us would be something that we'd think was kind of the question they had. It was a writing test, and they were asked to explain how they would integrate extracurricular in with their classroom activities. And she didn't know what the term extracurricular was because they do not have extracurricular in some other countries, and she taught elementary. And so fundamentally, she felt that that was a bias. Now, we've had these, we will have these discussions with the test makers, but again, I think the fundamental question here is how do we prepare teachers, and is a test like this, nobody complains about the pedagogical test. It's usually the basic skills test that seem to be the biggest problem.
Okay. Thank you, Dr. Smith. We'll look forward to the final recommendations. I would like to welcome Senator Nienau to the left side of the table. And we do not have this arranged this way.
So. Mr. Chair, I did note to my seatmate here that I'm the only bipartisan one in the room, apparently.
It's the holidays.
So. And Mr. Chair, we'd like to thank Senator Nienau and Senator Dahl. They've been very active members of this committee and have attended. So if you need any further information on the teacher licensure one, I'm sure they can fill you in as well, because you did appoint four legislators to actually serve on this task force.
Thank you.
And, Mr. Chair, I have one final task force. It's the Adult Standard Diploma Task Force. And the charge of this task force is to find a way to issue an actual high school diploma to adults who are no longer qualified for education in the K-12 system. And do not have their diploma, but they may they want to have a diploma from their schools or districts so they can take it out when they go to college, or they can go apply for a job. This task force was fairly small; it was about 8 or 9 members. We had representatives from business as well as higher ed and other people serving on the task force. This one's probably the furthest along, but they're going to. You've asked them to submit to recommendations to the commissioner for a rule. And we had somebody come in and talk to them about the rulemaking process, and they've decided they don't want to go through that because it takes too long. They want to get this program up and running sooner. And so I think this task force is going to come back with a recommendation for you to enact legislation, and they have some very clear guidelines. In fact, I'm working with them now to draft a piece of legislation. Some of the criteria they want is they want to have very specific standards, not only in the areas of writing and mathematics, et cetera, but in the areas of science and social studies. But they want those be able to be demonstrable based on experiential learning that they've had. They want to have some career skills included in this. In other words, being able to use a computer, how to do interviewing. They have other skill sets that they want to include in the requirements. They also want it to be portable. They want to be able, if an adult student starts in one district and they have this program laid out for them to get a diploma, they want it to be able to be transferable to another district in case they move. So they have some very specific things they want to see in this legislation, which we will then bring to you. I think they're quite a ways along, and I expect them to kind of reach consensus at their next meeting, which is next week, and we clearly hope to have a recommendation for legislation as opposed to rulemaking for you by the time session begins. I think they feel very good about what these recommendations will be, and the idea is that we then can give actual high school diplomas from a local school district to a candidate, and they then can use that diploma for other uses such as post-secondary education, employment, or other needs as that serves their needs. So that's where that program is at this point. Mainly these are people in adult basic ed programs. They don't feel this applies to all adult basic ed adult learners, but it will be for those who have met certain requirements and can meet the graduation standards or similar standards for that the state has for other high school students.
Questions on that task force? Very good. Any concluding remarks regarding the task force? Again, everything's also provided on the website for minutes and number of documents that have helped
good
lead
reading
the discussion.
If you want to go to bed at night and read some of those reports, there's a lot of information. I do want to mention just one other thing. Integration, you had given direction to the department to align the rule with the law, because when you pass a new statute, the rule does not align with what you passed in statute. I have pulled together another work group. It's not required in the statute, and we are in the process of meeting, and we hope to have a report back to you about how to better align the rule, or else to either eliminate the rule and incorporate into statute what needs to be done, because right now the rule and the law are not consistent. And I do, and Senator Torres-Rae and Representative Carlos Mariani are working. We've invited them to be part of that task force along with Senator Nelson and one House member from the Republican House Caucus. So we will have more for you as well. You've kept me very busy this summer. I want to thank you all very much.
Thanksgiving dinner, too, right? Okay. Thank you very much, all the testifiers, and we look forward to your final recommendations. Next, the 2014 session update, and we have from the department, Darren Corte, and welcome. And provide some overview comments, and whether it's on the unsession or where you're at on different ideas that are coming up, and we can open it up for any comments or questions on that as well as time permits. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Madam Chair, members. My name is Darren Corte. I'm the Director of Government Relations at the Minnesota Department of Education. I'm here to talk to you a little bit about the MDE approach to the 2014 legislative session. As some of you may know, we have kind of an internal process on how we develop our legislative recommendations. Basically, the commissioner engages the staff and asks them to kind of point out things that maybe they've found in statute that could have some improvement or things that they've been hearing from stakeholders, from districts, from students, from parents about ways that statutes can be improved. And those are submitted to the commissioner for her review and approval. So we've kind of gone through that process already, and those proposals have been sent along to the governor's office. Part of those proposals include some technical implementation issues that we've run into with the legislation that was passed last year. Obviously, with the large amount of legislation that was passed in education last year, along with the changes that were made in the tax committee, there's probably going to be some changes that we're going to need to do just to make sure that all the formulas are working correctly and the money's getting out the way that you all intended it to. We have been working with the fiscal staff from both the House and the Senate on those issues, and the chairs have been notified about some of those implementation issues, so some of those should already be on your radar. When we send these things to these proposals to the governor's office, things get kind of separated into two pots, and that's, you know, policy and budget, much like how things work on the legislative side. The policy proposals we're really hoping to get turned around quickly. We know that we have a short session coming up, and with the short session is going to come very short deadlines, so we're not going to have the fortune of being able to wait until the bill gets introduced and then start having hearings and conversations with everybody. So we're really pushing the governor's office, especially on the policy end, to get those the policy proposals approved and turned around so we can start sharing them with members and sharing them with stakeholders and having conversations before session starts so that when it starts, we're ready to move. I would like to talk a little bit about unsession since it was brought up. As you know, the governor has charged all of the executive agencies with identifying areas where we can remove or eliminate some obsolete statutes, remove or eliminate unnecessary reporting requirements, or find ways that we can make reporting requirements that exist less burdensome for in our case, mostly teachers, districts, and other stakeholders. So as part of that, you know, this is actually a process I feel like our staff does pretty much every year, is going through the statutes and trying to, you know, find ways to eliminate redundancies and areas where there is unnecessary burden being placed on districts. But I think this year we really took a fine-tooth comb to the statutes. We were actually asked by the governor's office to go through all 700 pages of education-related statutes, kind of page by page, and identify ones that we thought might be candidates for repeal. So that's been done with the commissioner, and that's also been sent to the governor's office and is being reviewed. I believe Commissioner Tony Sertich from the IRRRB is heading up the effort there, along with a committee from the different agencies, to go through all the proposals that the agencies have submitted, but also the proposals that were submitted by the public through the website, as well as proposals that were submitted during the state fair. So that kind of vetting process is going on in the governor's office now, as I understand. And as far as timeline goes, as I said, you know, we understand that there's going to be a late start to session, so we're really kind of pushing to get those policy and technical items approved, so kind of after the first of the year, we can begin having conversations on those. Budget is a little bit unclear. The governor has stated that he intends to wait until after the November forecast before any budget decisions are made, supplemental budget decisions are made. So hopefully we'll be getting some information back from the governor's office soon, since we'll be getting the forecast report tomorrow. But besides that, you know, if there are items that members are working on that they'd like us to take a look at, we're always happy to see that. And the same with stakeholders. We have been working with some members on going through ideas that they have moving into this next session. So we're always open to having those conversations and look forward to working with you all in the 2014 session.
Thank you, Mr. Cordy. Questions, suggestions, comments? Mr. Cordy. I was wondering, have you surveyed your various stakeholders, whether it's the superintendent, school districts, various groups that you work with regarding areas that could be repealed? And here, we just put in a number of new reporting requirements and task forces, but maybe there are some areas where there's consensus where it's not needed. We don't want something that's not productive, obviously, but you've gone through a process to formally ask on this?
Mr. Chair, yes, our staff on a regular basis, our subject level, you know, expert staff, the ones that are dealing with kind of the boots on the ground folks, we really ask them at the outset to engage the stakeholders that they work with to see if there's reports that they're required to submit to us that maybe, you know, are placing more of a burden upon those stakeholders than we might know, or maybe aren't producing the value for the amount of effort that is being required of them. So, yes, we have been doing that. I've also been meeting with the different lobbyists from stakeholder organizations as they are kind of firming up their legislative platforms for the upcoming session. And I think, as always, reducing mandates and reducing reporting requirements is high on the list of priorities for them.
Okay. Thank you. Members, anything you'd like to share as you prepare for the upcoming session? In terms of proposals, I've talked to several of you. Actually, I've been going to some districts where they've asked me to be out there to learn more and enjoy that, and obviously continue doing that yourself as the advocate for your area. And I believe, Senator Torres Ray, you may have a couple of announcements regarding committee plans as we prepare for the upcoming session.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. We've been working hard to meet with a lot of people who have had requests, but basically there are four very important issues that we're going to bring in the policy committee. One is a response to a request from several members to really review kind of charter school language and some different aspects about performance in charter schools. We have some members who are very concerned about academic performance of some kids in some of their schools, and they want me to really have a hearing to open that for the public to really listen to that. The issue around teacher training has become really a very important one for most of the districts. People are very eager to hear what is that we want to review, propose, somewhat tied to licensure, but not really. I think people are very concerned that we are not talking about providing resources when we're talking about a lot of restructuring. ELL policy has become a very important conversation as well. The districts are feeling like they really need to have more resources, but members are saying we need to have reform, so we really need to combine the two. And then we have these six task forces that we really need to review. So I know that there have been multiple issues that people want to talk about, decisions related to the investments that we're making in early childhood education and how we are assessing children and reading assessments and literacy assessments and ELL assessments and how they tie together in terms of measuring, third grade levels. So we're going to try to review that. The investments that we did in education, whether or not, the cap was a good thing to do or not, and what is happening to some of the low-income families that we really wanted to target and cannot afford to go to these quality centers. So a lot of issues that have been brought to my attention, Mr. Chair and members, that we need to review. So please, if you have anything in your list, make sure that you get it to us as quickly as you can. I know that Brad and Blanca have been diligent about, keeping track of all the information that comes to my office, but please let us know if you have anything in your mind that you want us to start researching and putting on the agenda for February. So thank you.
Thanks. Further comments or suggestions by members, and if you want to do that individually as well for any constructive suggestions too, it will be a short session, and I imagine it'll be a few weeks or so that we'll have committee hearings. You pretty much know through task forces we're going to hear recommendations from them. Obviously, it's not a budget year. There potentially could be some supplemental money, but we have an obligation on the payback of the schools, and we've put together our budget. And we've put together a number of very exciting, comprehensive goals that are laid out in World's Best Workforce, starting for Ready for K, reading proficiency, grade 3, all students graduating, college career readiness. It's all there. We all want it. And let's see if the tools that we've given districts, if it's working. And if we need to fine-tune anything, I don't have any major initiatives that I'm looking at. Let's see what we have right now. And if we need to fine-tune anything, if there was any unintended consequence, obviously tax committee did a number of things regarding the bills, some depending on, maybe there, as Senator Jensen pointed out, there may be some additional opportunity there, but we know there's a dollar ramification in finance if we're going to alter anything. So there's a number of temptations to offer a number of additional suggestions, and I've heard from many of you with some great ideas, but it's not a additional budget year unless there's a boatload of additional funds coming, and I don't believe that's realistic. So let's settle in, look at the accomplishments that we've made, the many expectations we've given to district, and let's let it work and keep reviewing those reports and suggestions that are going to be coming from these groups. So that's where I'm at and going into session, and if there's anything additional that you want to share, but it should be a relatively quick one, and so it'd be just a few weeks of gathering together, but I'm not looking at a large new spending bill of any sort, and maybe just making any needed corrections, revisions, if that was necessary. So if there's – yes, Senator Carlson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have one question that I'm wondering. We repeated it many times that we're having a short session. It's starting very late. But looking at these task force dates here, most of them are either mid or early February. And I'm wondering if there's going to be any – if there are some efficiencies we can realize if we meet pre-session for any hearings of these. Is there any plan for that?
Yes, and I know that some will, some vacation plans pre-session might be occurring, but I would imagine you'll see at least a couple of meetings in January and February for efficiency. We're not going to go in deep freeze in January or before session, but once we get these reports, then we'll formally go through them again. There will be. Obviously, on the school facilities, we're probably looking at hundreds of millions of dollars, potentially. But we at least get that out on the table. But there will very likely be some meetings prior to the convening of legislative session. Mm-hmm. And we'll give you as far advance notice on that as we can. And I've been trying to find out some of your schedules and I would imagine it might start again maybe January 10 or so, and at least two or three times before the start of session we would be meeting. And again, there are some district meetings too, and if where we're going out and talking to people, and if you'd be interested in more of that in your own area, you don't necessarily need me or others, but make sure you're doing that as well, actively listening. Further comments, questions? Well, if not, thank you for your service on the respective committees, and happy holidays to you and your loved ones over the season. We are adjourned.
Thank you.
Thank you.